This is going to be super interactive, and I'm going to, so this will be perfect. So we'll just ignore this table here. So let me just start with prayer, and then let's get started. So Lord, thank you so much, as always, for who you are and what you're doing here and around the world. Lord, we pray that you would just guide and direct this time together, Lord, that it would not just be our ideas and our thoughts, but it would be yours. You would speak to us. Lord, there's such a need here and around the world, Lord. We need your power. It can't be our ideas. So lead and direct us now, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so for those of you who don't know me, my name is Aaron Pierce. I am with a mission organization called Steiger International, and we're focused on reaching what we call the global youth culture. And that's really going to be the topic today, is understanding what is the global youth culture and then what can we do about reaching them. So let me just give you a little history of myself, and then we'll dive into the topic. So our mission organization, Steiger, is actually a Dutch word. My parents were missionaries in Amsterdam in the early 80s with Youth with a Mission, and they had a real heart for reaching the young people of the city. This was at the height of the punk rock movement in the 80s, and so they were saying, God, how can we reach these punks? And at that time, the anarchistic movement was big, and they're saying, God, how can we reach these people who have such negative views of you and what it means to follow Jesus? And so my dad, who's a very creative guy, started a band, at that time a punk band, to go into the clubs where he was very present, so that's in the bottom right corner there, and share Jesus in the language that the people there could understand. And then they started to see a ton of people from that context come to Jesus, and then the challenge was, well, what do we do with all of them? Because to step into a traditional church context was just way too big of a leap. So what they did is they started a Bible study on a big red boat behind Central Station in Amsterdam. So if you've been to Amsterdam and actually got out of the airport, then you've been to Central Station because you have to. And behind that is a river. And so they had this big red boat, and the address was Pier 14. The Dutch word for pier is Steiger. So the name of their, what became a church, was just the address, Steiger 14, a Dutch word. And then what happened is this band, No Longer Music, started to get opportunities to go other places in Europe. They started, you know, in Germany and communist Poland and beyond. And a lot of people started to get saved and inspired, and they would identify themselves with the church back in Amsterdam and say, we're part of Steiger. And so really without a strategic plan, this missions movement called Steiger International developed. And it has grown to the point where we're operating in Europe, in the Middle East, South America, Australasia, and now starting off in Asia as well, focused on what we call the global youth culture. And so that's what we're going to talk about, because this idea of the global youth culture is relevant everywhere. That's the whole point of it all. And it's more and more relevant today because of the worldview of the global youth culture here in the U.S. than any time before. So I'm going to dig into, I think if you're going to reach people, obviously, as good missionaries, as evangelists, we need to know people. We need to know how they think. We need to know how they see the world, what influences them. And so that's my main objective, is first to help understand what is the global youth culture, and then we can respond by what do we do about that. So again, this whole session, I want it to be super interactive, so if you have a question or a comment or a thought, jump in. I'll have opportunities for you to do that for sure. But let's dig into that. Now, so before we do that, to illustrate this and to warm us up a little bit, we're going to do a little bit of a quiz, okay? So what I want you to do, take a picture or write down the name of these six countries, and then I'm going to show you in a second images of people, young people that we've engaged with that are from one of these six countries, okay? So I'm already giving you the answers, and what you need to do is then identify which one of the six countries, USA, Turkey, Albania, Brazil, Lebanon, and Ukraine, which one of these six countries they're from? All right? So let's get started. Take a look at this first one. Where do you... You need to go back. Yeah, there you go. USA, Turkey, Albania, Brazil, Lebanon, Ukraine. Okay? All right. Here we go. First one. Take a look. Now, don't say it out loud. In a second, we'll go through and give you the answer. So write down which country you think these group of kids are from. All right, let's go to the next one. Another group, obviously cell phones are quite prominent amongst the global youth culture. All right, next one. Take a look at this fella and the people around him. Next one, another group of guys here. I know this is easy, but bear with me. All right, this one. And finally this one. Okay. All right, so remember, these were the places. Now let's see how you did. Where do you think these kids are from? Say it out loud.
Brazil.
I put Brazil down. Brazil. Ukraine.
Lebanon.
You're all wrong. It's Albania. All right, so Albania, of course, is a very poor country in Eastern Europe. Globalization, global youth culture, it's not just a rich Western thing. It's global. So you see it everywhere. What about this one? Turkey.
USA.
Brazil. Guess Brazil every time. Eventually we'll be right. That's a good strategy. I like that. Actually, you guys are right over there. It's Turkey, which is surprising because Turkey is 99.99% Muslim, and those girls don't look like Muslims to me. And it shows how global youth culture is impacting young people in traditionally unreached places and how they're reshaping the way they see the world. Okay? What about this guy?
Brazil.
Brazil, good strategy. Still wrong. Ukraine. All right. Eastern Europe. What about these fellas?
Brazil.
Lebanon. Someone over there is acing or cheating. We'll find out later. What about these guys?
U.S.
Cultural clue. If they're smiling, they're probably Americans. And then finally, Brazil. Yes. All right. So who got two or more right? I know you guys back there did. Anyone get three or more right? Oh, man, we got work to do. All right, so you understand the point, right? So the global youth culture, obviously there's things of race and ethnicity that you can't get around, but the cultural dynamics of this global youth culture is making them virtually indistinguishable from each other. We're going to talk about how that has happened. For us, the age group is 17 to 35-year-olds, so young adults, older Gen Z, all over the globe, representing a billion people, and even though they're spread out, they're more connected than ever before. So to illustrate this, I'm going to show there's a missionary that I know from Beirut, Lebanon, and just talking about globalization in the Middle East and how it's very much shaping, changing the way things are done even there amongst young people. So let's take a look at this.
So Beirut is very much a cosmopolitan, free and crazy city, so Lebanon allows its citizens to express what they think. So, and because the young generation is skeptical about religion, skeptical towards culture, you would find people take their freedom to express that, which leads to Beirut being very much an epicenter or a thriving hub for culture and arts and music. Every evening you could go to concerts, to graffiti workshops or to design workshops or poetry nights or you name it. It's very much a vibrating city. Again, it's people really taking the opportunity to express their desires, to express their longings, to express their dissatisfaction. So this for us opens up a great way or creates a great platform to come in and proclaim the gospel. Again, it would be wrong to think that because they're Arabs and because we're in the Middle East, we should try and create bridges by kind of communicating Jesus through the Quran or kind of taking up those verses in the Quran where it talks about Jesus and all that sort of stuff. But with the young generation in the Middle East who is already disconnected from institutionalized religion, that won't work, or that would just be even more proof for them that we're not understanding them. Whereas music and art and creative means or digital means are just the perfect ways to connect with that generation and talk about Jesus.
So it's interesting how it's impacting, kind of changing the influence and the worldview in even the more traditionally unreached places around the world. Of course, Beirut is an interesting place, very open, and they kind of call it the Las Vegas of the Middle East because a lot of Gulf Arabs go there to do what they can't do in their conservative culture. But their worldview and their influences are changing, and so it's a really interesting dynamic. So let's talk a little bit, and if you have a question or thought, jump in. Let's talk a little bit about influences of the global youth culture. There's a lot, obviously, but they really fall into four main categories. So first is pop culture, entertainment industry. So your rock star, your pop culture, you know, people that are influencing. So you've got, you know, she's a little off her peak now, but you've got people like Taylor Swift who are influencing people, but not just kind of in random entertainment, there's a worldview behind it. There's especially your latest stuff is really starting to push a particular worldview. You've got the rise of internet stars, so people whose entire platform is on the internet, YouTubers who are vlogging daily and things like that. And so you've got people that are young people that are consuming content in entirely different ways. And then you've got, of course, the rise of video games, which is actually bigger industry than Hollywood, where people are spending their entire, finding their identity and their community and their sense of accomplishment in the world of video games. And also, again, it's not just entertainment. It is pushing worldview. It is shaping how people think. And then lastly, and perhaps most scary, is how pervasive pornography is and how it is everywhere. And so common and so nothing to be ashamed of, where, you know, the studies where it's young people think it's worse to not recycle than it is to view pornography, and there's not even a sense of shame about it. We just share talk openly about it. And obviously this stuff is reshaping our views on sexuality and relationship and marriage and all of that. So these are some of the things that are influencing culture. And it's, again, it's not just a Western thing. It's influencing globally. Illustrate that. Anyone know who this is? This is, you guys back there might know, this is Logan Paul. He's a big YouTuber. I think he's in the 19 million subscribers now. And he produces vlogs, daily content. It's mostly garbage in terms of content. It's just kind of like a lot of shock stuff. But it has a huge following and a huge influence. Okay, so to illustrate this, this is him in Dubai not too long ago, and this is the reception he got, just so you see the influence that this guy has. Oh, go back there. So you get the point, right? It's amazing. This guy shows up in Dubai and that's the reception he gets for posting just kind of random, meaningless daily vlogs. So huge influence, okay? Obviously, another example, do you guys know who this is? Oop, go back. Do you know who that is? Billie Eilish. She's huge right now, a pop star, a huge influence, kind of a counter reaction to Taylor Swift, who's more, you know, got it all together. She is way more quote-unquote real and talks about her problems. Huge influence. This is a concert she did just recently in Prague. You hear kids in Prague singing her lyrics, and the lyrics are super interesting. Huge influence. Billie Eilish is her name. Did you capture that line at the end there? It said, "We're all the same." It's kind of interesting, ironic in the whole global youth culture. So she goes places all over the globe, and that's kind of the reception she gets. Ken, that's not new, but it shows you this kind of global influence all over the world. So let's talk a little bit about what are they like. Okay, so first and foremost, obviously connected, right? Like never before because of the internet. Also because of travel. Travel's cheaper today than it ever used to be. People are connecting more personally more than they ever have. So, but they're extremely connected, but they're also socially isolated. So this is that dichotomy where we have more friends, quote unquote, than ever before, but we're really more alone than ever before. And so we have this extreme social isolation. The whole rise of social media and YouTube and things like that have created this idea we're obsessed with fame and being followed. So our identity, our value is wrapped up in our followers and our likes and our views. And then you have this weird thing where something isn't real until it's posted. So you've got this new axiom, I post, therefore I am, right? That's reality. I can be in this beautiful place, but to experience it, it isn't real until I've posted that. And so it's this really strange reality that has an impact on how we experience life and how it really creates a sense of dissatisfaction because we're constantly seeing how other people are, you know, their perfect lives and how it's all being represented. We have incredible sexual brokenness because of the way that sexuality has been redefined, obviously very much not in a biblical way, and how that's impacting people's views on relationships and, you know, of course, sexuality of all kinds, and having tremendous negative consequences because of the sexual brokenness that people are facing, leading to a sense of confusion. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you one question about that. Obsessed with fame.
Yeah.
Facebook is considering taking away the likes because they see that, you know, so many people are obsessed.
Yep.
And they think that they're only worth something if they get a lot of likes.
Yep.
Are a lot of the young pop stars and such pushing back on that?
I haven't heard that, and I'd be very surprised because they would be taking away the addiction that gets people to come back to Facebook. And Facebook is not even the primary one amongst younger. But honestly, I don't buy that because that would the hit that you get, the chemical hit from getting likes and following is what brings you back to social media sites. So
chemically, it's the same as cocaine.
That's right. That's right. No, it is. And so it's actually, we are addicted to social media exactly because of the like button. And because that's where you, those stats and those numbers is what we, it's why when you post something, you check how many people are liking it, like every 30 seconds, because you want to see if it's getting more likes or whatever.
I was wondering why they were even considering this, you know, if they were under pressure from, you know, political.
Well, it's one of those things where, everyone, this isn't like revolutionary stuff. People realize the negative consequences, but we're too addicted to do anything about it. And certainly Facebook is too, you know, has too much money in it to do anything about it. But yeah, it's a big issue. Did you say something? No. Okay. Let's keep going then. Oh, so confusion, anxiety, this is, you know, we have a huge rise in mental health issue and depression. And it's almost interesting, like I said with Billie Eilish, it's now, rather than it kind of used to be something to be ashamed of, now it's almost something to be proud of. And like to a point where people are like, it's almost like it's a trend to talk about your mental health issues, which in one sense is good. In another sense, it creates other problems because it kind of is a copycat idea. But it all comes to that idea of confusion and anxiety and the sense of being consumers. But I think especially amongst younger, consumer looks different. So consumers of their parents' generation might have been big house, nice job, big fancy car, thing like that. But what a lot of them saw from that was divorce and unhappiness. And so it's like, well, I'm going to react away from that. Everyone's kind of has a sense that material things aren't going to satisfy me, so I'm going to find it in experiences. I'm going to find it in being kind of unencumbered, free to kind of go where I want, when I want. And so you see a lot of people that are finding their own kind of new way of consumerism in that life. So a YouTube channel that I actually really like, but that totally plays into this is a YouTube channel called Yes Theory. And their whole idea is to kind of say yes to life and taking risk and seek discomfort, but it's all experiential and it's all a different form of consumerism. This is what's going to make you happy. Rather than the material stuff, now you're just going to be free and unencumbered to experience different things in life. And again, it's all this social media view of life that looks perfect, but in reality isn't how it actually is. And so you see a lot of that. And then finally, all of this kind of adds up to this level of dissatisfaction. This kind of low grade, in some cases not so low grade, the feeling of dissatisfaction. And it has to do with just kind of this seeing, comparing other people's view of life versus yours and it not matching up. But it, just a general sense of dissatisfaction is what you see. Now, some of these things, and I'll get into that, these are opportunities for the gospel, right? And when people are aware that there's problems, when they're searching for answers that they're not finding, these are opportunities for the gospel. And certainly there are many, many opportunities in the way that the global youth culture thinks to bring in the gospel. So let's talk about high-level philosophical pillars of the global youth culture. So first one is secularism. And so what this does not mean is that everyone is an atheist. Okay, so this means that religious views have been marginalized and privatized to the point where you can believe whatever you want, so as long as it doesn't enter the public sphere, so as long as you're not pushing your views on others, you can believe whatever you want. That's what secularism is in the global youth culture. So institutional religion has been pushed aside. You know, religious views are kind of just become vague spiritual views. But it's this idea, so long as you're not kind of forcing your views on others, that's what that means. And that naturally leads, of course, to the idea of relativism, that there is no transcendent truth, that morality is like an ice cream flavor. You have your favorites and I have mine, but we can't really settle it between us. And so, and it's, of course, a super incoherent thing, because you can say that you believe in a kind of moral relativism, which is the predominant thing you'll hear if you talk to people, but we can't actually live that way, because at some point something is wrong and something is right. But this is what you hear, is this idea of moral relativism. And then that lends itself finally to the idea of tolerance. But tolerance in this context is poorly defined, because tolerance here means all ideas are equal. And if you criticize someone else's views, someone else's idea, you're a hater, you're a bigot. And so then you get this paradoxical moment where all is tolerated except the intolerant, and all is included except the exclusive. And so that becomes kind of the big philosophical pillars. And as I already said, I think the biggest tension in all of this is what you hear if you ask people on the streets their worldview, but you can't actually live this way. And so you'll see a lot of borrowing from Judeo-Christian views on you know, morality and justice and love, because even though their worldview actually doesn't offer that. And so you see actually a lot of confusion and incoherence in terms of what they say and then actually how they live. So that's a big issue. So I'm going to show you something. This is a guy. He does most of his content actually on Facebook. His name's Nas. He's a Palestinian Muslim, but really is a Palestinian secular humanist. Super influential. And he produces these videos as he travels all over the world and produces these really well-done videos. And this is a video that he released not too long ago. And it perfectly illustrates what I'm talking about in terms of the worldview of the global youth culture. So let's take a look.
This video is about me. But by the end of it, it's about you. Because this is the story of acceptance. For 18 years, I grew up as a Muslim in a small village this size. And in my personal world, I did not accept different religions or different people. I was a Muslim believing I was right. So this is the story of how I went from accepting no one to accepting everyone. One day, I traveled outside of my Muslim village here to Varanasi, India, the Mecca of the Hindus. And once I landed there, I was shocked. Because I saw Hindus who believe there are millions of gods, not one, who believe this river is holy, who believe they must be burned after death. And as a Muslim, you do not agree with any of this. You tell yourself, they must be wrong and you must be right. They must be wrong and you must be right. But soon you'll realize, there is no right and there is no wrong. You don't have to agree with the 1 billion Hindus, but you must accept it as peoples. This isn't just religion, this is everything else. When I first came to the United States, I made a new friend. He told me he wants to be a lawyer. I said, that's okay. Then he told me he's gay. I said, that's not okay. But then why is that not okay? Because it doesn't fit in my world? Then maybe my world is not big enough, and then it's okay to be gay. It's okay to be Hindu. It's okay to be Muslim. It's okay to be whatever. Travel, the more you realize that maybe your village doesn't have all the answers. And that might be the hardest thing to realize in your life. I said this video is not about me, because really, it's about you. Because one day you'll see something you don't like, something you think is wrong, and you'll say to yourself, I must be right. The truth is, no one is right and no one is wrong. The world is much bigger than a village, and the best way to live in it is to accept everyone for who they are.
So you go to that video, and it's, speaking of likes, filled with likes, filled with comments of this is awesome, this is right. But as you say, that comment, the truth is self-refuting, right? Yeah. So almost, and this is why this verse is up here, because logically speaking, it's not even an argument worth having because it's so weak, right? And I can say, don't you see the self-refuting nature of what you're saying? You're cutting off the branch you're on. But here's the problem. The God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers. This is not just a logical issue. This is a spiritual issue. This is a spiritual blindness issue and deception. And it doesn't matter how many times I point at that wall and say, look at it. If you are blind, you cannot see it. And so this is primarily and first and foremost a spiritual issue where the global youth culture is being deceived and being lied to the point where they believe very illogical things, where you can say the truth is no one is right, no one is wrong, and no one laughs at you, right? Because they're like, yes, that's right. And so our first issue is we need to pray for eyes to be open to hear the gospel, because people are spiritually blind. This is our greatest issue among the global youth culture. That's why you see people who can hold these incoherent views. It's because of the spiritual blindness. Any other like comments or thoughts on that last video?
So I'm reading. It's almost like it's an appeal to emotion and
yes,
felt truth.
Of course.
It's not about logical coherence and making sense.
Yeah.
It's like you just feel this.
Yeah.
You've traveled. So
feels good, right? Yeah.
It's gotta be right.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
But just boils down to, I don't want to offend anybody.
Yeah.
So accept everything, and then everything is right.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
What they're saying is right. It's like Robbie talks about, you know, we have some neighbors who love each other and some neighbors who eat each other. Do you have
yeah,
a preference?
Yeah, exactly. Classic Robbie line. Exactly right.
You say so this goes to saying what is true in my world is true because I believe it.
Yep.
And so then you get to this point where anything anyone says is true because it's in their world. So if you don't accept it, well...
Yeah, but it's a weird thing because one of the things you'll hear a lot, which I know it's even been political, that's not my intention here, but you hear your truth. Mm-hmm. What does your truth mean, right? There's truth and there's not truth. But so you'll hear a lot of, you know, I'm pursuing my truth, and there's this idea that I can believe what I believe, and it can completely be in contradiction to what someone else believed, but that's okay. You know, and because we don't even want to go there because that's just kind of burst that bubble. So, yeah, that's a lot of what you hear. Any other thoughts or comments? Okay, we'll keep going. So the worldview that's underlining all of this is secular humanism. God has been replaced. Man is at the center. And this secular humanistic worldview is really the worldview even when people nominally subscribe to a religious view. So even in the Muslim world or the Hindu world or the Christian world, a lot of people will identify as a Muslim, but like this last guy, their worldview, the way they think, is a secular humanist. And which means that actually approaching them in through like Muslim apologetics isn't relevant. Secular humanistic apologetics is more relevant to someone that has that worldview. And so it's an interesting dynamic because it's in name they appear one way, but in worldview and thinking it's secular humanism. And this is the predominant worldview today.
So the funny thing about this is in mindset you think, oh, we're losing the culture, but in another mindset is now you're not having to learn every culture to be able to speak truth into their life, because it's like Satan's shooting himself in the foot because he's making everybody think the same way with a terrible argument that allows us to blow up their bubble easily.
Yeah. Exactly. So it's interesting. Every one of these things, there are challenges that bring opportunity. And so this does bring opportunities. So there are ways that we can engage the Muslim world, the Hindu world, like never before because of this. Now, there's plenty of problems, and we'll get into that. There are also negative consequences to the secular humanistic worldview. But yes, it also creates opportunities for the gospel. Other thoughts or questions? Okay, so I'm going to show you a video now. I live in Minnesota, and so we do a lot of ministry there. We went to the University of Minnesota, a big, large secular university, and did some worldview questions to people on the streets. And actually, last Saturday, we did a focus group for the first time where we took people and we actually, for an hour and a half, really dug into worldview questions. Really interesting. But I'm going to show you this because, again, we're going to dig into the U.S. side. But just hear this worldview as from people on the streets, and then we'll analyze that a little bit.
How do you think we all got here? How did life begin?
It started with the Big Bang. I don't really know much more than that.
So I believe in evolution and that we evolved from primates. I mean, there's proof that our DNA is 98% the same as chimpanzees, so.
Probably just like a meteorite with like some microbes on it that landed on Earth from a different planet and like eventually evolved to become humans.
What is the purpose of life?
Let me know when you figure it out.
Yeah. I'm still working on that one.
Make your own. Like, I don't think there's no like grand purpose for anybody. Just like everyone is just. There is no purpose. Make up your own purpose and run with it.
Help continue the evolution of human beings as a species. So how do you think that right and wrong are decided?
I think it's different for like everyone, depending on like what they think is right and wrong. Because like people believe in different things, so it can't be the same for everyone.
That goes back to like your morals, I guess. Because your right can be someone else's wrong. So it's all like based on your morality, I take it.
I think that like it depends on yourself and what you think is right and wrong and what you believe in. And as long as you stick to your beliefs and like carry out what the Bible says or what the Quran says or like whatever, then like you're living your life to the fullest and that's all that matters.
What do you think happens after we die?
I don't know. I mean, isn't that kind of the beauty of it? You know, there's a lot of people who are spiritual and have things in which they believe in, and so it's kind of a manifest of what you believe. I also feel like that is subjective because no one knows, and so I think that's kind of the beauty of it.
Nothing happens, and hopefully you live your best life, and if there is an afterlife, hopefully I live within the boundaries and make it there, you know what I mean? So
I believe in heaven. I for sure believe in heaven. I don't know if I believe in hell. I think that like if you want to believe in hell, then you'll probably go to hell. Like
rather than being showered well, living in some place where you have to have wings and a heart, hopefully we just get reabsorbed into that consciousness that allows the oceans to move and the tides and rivers and the trees to grow. And I hope. And maybe there's nothing. Either way, it doesn't matter.
So there's more there, but pretty interesting stuff,
you
right?
Just go through and pick out the most ridiculous people you can find.
Yeah. But here's the thing, and I guess this is going back to the deceived verse, right? Actually, our hearts, but we shouldn't be laughing, we should be crying, right? Because these people are deceived and are so far away from Jesus. Like, and this is not just like, let's find the weird nuts and hear that. This is what you hear consistently. And so our hearts should be broken for a variety of reasons. Here's I think, a big point. Once a society accepts a worldview, it tends to work out the logical consequences. Obviously, from an eternal perspective, the consequences are pretty dire. But even here on Earth, the consequences are dire. By the way, a book I really like, and an author, Nancy Percy, really good apologist, but her book, Love Thy Body, which is based on Christian view of sexuality, really, really good. But she's the one who says this. And if you think, you consider what are the consequences of the secular humanistic worldview amongst the global youth culture, and it really boils down to two things: loneliness and meaninglessness. We have, as we've kind of alluded to already, we have an epidemic of loneliness among the global culture where people are incredibly alone, where they have no real, deep, meaningful relationships. There's a lot of studies now saying with this rise in depression and that actually people are not depressed, they're just lonely. And that this is a major issue in our culture. And then the other one is meaninglessness, the sense that the secular humanist worldview does not offer transcendent purpose. It doesn't. If you're just a product of time and chance and you're eventually going to end up in the dirt, there's no purpose. What's the point of living a quote-unquote good life and living for others or having some form of purpose when really secular humanism doesn't offer it? And so you see people react in one of two ways. You have one is escapism. So people kind of run from this, and it can be extreme, like drugs and alcohol and all that, but it's often just a lot of entertainment, a lot of Netflix, a lot of video games, so that I don't have to think about the big, deep, scary thoughts of the world. And then the other one is depression and increased rates of suicide. Because you ask me, why is it that statistically suicide has greatly increased amongst young people in this country? Why is it? Because obviously suicide and mental health is a very complex thing with multiple factors, environmental as well as, you know, genetic and all that. But if you ask me why is it increasing, I think it's because of our worldview. It's because we have a worldview that doesn't offer purpose. And people are so hungry for relationship. They're so hungry for something of meaning and purpose in their life. These are opportunities for the gospel. You know, as missionaries, we learn the language of the people we're called to reach, and then we communicate the gospel, we speak to felt needs. This is the felt need of the global youth culture, is loneliness and meaninglessness, and these are opportunities. More than having arguments about, you know, how the earth began and kind of like evolutionary conversations, this is the heart of where a lot of people are at, and where you can really make inroads, and you see people that are, you know, open. Now, I was going to show a video of a YouTuber, but in light of the fact that we have kids, I'm not, because there's some not-so-good language in it. But there's a YouTuber called Elle Mills. She's Canadian, and she blew up in like subscribers really, really fast and then had a big meltdown. Elle Mills, E-L-L-E-M-I-L-L-S. If you want to see the video I'm talking about, Google YouTube Elle Mills breakdown. And you'll see it. But it's really interesting because she talks about how she found everything she wanted in life and is not happy. And then really, in a really pretty provocative and raw way, talks about how unhappy she is. And the reason I show that is kind of what I said before. Our hearts to this, our response to this should be that of a broken heart. I'm just going to, well, yeah. One second here.
Is that what she looks like?
Yeah, okay. I mean, this is her right here. But anyway, I don't want to show it because it's pretty good language. So our response to this should be that of Nehemiah in chapter 1, verse 4, when he said, "When I heard these things, I sat down and I wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven." The only way that we're going to be able to make an impact in the global youth culture, which is going to be here in Portland, all over the U.S., and all over the world, is if our hearts break. Because the extent to which our heart break is the extent that we're going to do something about it. And it's really, really easy in our culture and the way that our culture is today with the us versus them and kind of hiding from the world is that it's really easy for us to kind of laugh at people and to kind of think, how stupid are they? But what we need is for God to break a heart. And I don't know about you, but for me, my natural inclination is selfishness. And so for me, to have a broken heart starts in repentance and saying, God, my heart is not broken. And frankly, my heart is selfish. Would you break my heart? And because I think what's so cool about the story of Nehemiah is that he didn't rush to action when he was made aware of the problem. The walls in Jerusalem are ruined. The city's vulnerable. He doesn't rush to action. He fasts and he mourns, some say for months, because the heart was so broken before he had the courage to take action. And I think that's what it takes. The problem is, especially in the U.S., we have some unique challenges to reaching the global youth culture. So the religiously unaffiliated are the fastest growing, quote-unquote, religious group in the U.S. So this is the fastest growing group. And especially pronounced amongst younger, so 1 in 11 older Gen Z can be characterized as engaged Christians, according to Barna, based on certain criteria. But I think this is an important thing to understand. I think this is, forgive my not so nice graphic here, but I think this is we historically in America have lived in a Christian nation, right? That doesn't mean everyone was a Christian, but we had this cultural Christianity, nominal Christianity, in which vast majority of people, 70, 80, whatever percent, identified as a Christian and had a certain biblical worldview. And so you had this high degree of nominal Christians and then a certain percentage of convictional Christians. However you want to define that, the point is there was nominals, there was convictional. What's happening is where there used to be a social benefit to being connected to the church. That's where you found your spouse and your business partners and your social circle and everything. Now there's a social cost. Because if you hold to biblical morality, now like we've talked about, now you're a bigot. Now you're a hater. And so what's happening is the people that were flowing with the stream of nominal Christianity are now flowing to secularism. And so we're not necessarily losing a bunch of convictional Christians, but the nominals are becoming secular. And so what that means is the people outside the church or the people that are not saved see the world differently than they used to. They have a secular worldview rather than a nominal worldview. And that's important to understand because if we're going to reach people, we need to understand how they see the world. And historically in the U.S., we were reaching a nominal Christian nation. That's why a lot of the heroes of the past, the way that we engaged people was towards a person, people like this. Because that was the audience and that made sense. So to put this in another way real quickly here, consider how people view Christianity. Okay, so on the left you have biblical Christianity, people that followers of Jesus, you know, that this real followers of Jesus. Far left you get legalistic, that's a whole other topic about putting extra barriers in the way, come to Jesus plus. But then as we move to the right, you have people that have that sympathetic, favorable, nominal view of Christianity. Again, this was the vast majority of Christians in America, or people, sorry, historically in America. Is people fit that sympathetic nominal. Then as you move along, you have people that are apathetic, don't care one way or the other. People that have a negative or cynical view. And then finally, you have people that have this anti-Christian or hostile view. Okay, so anytime you have people that fit all these paradigms, the challenge is the vast majority of evangelism today in America and actually around the world is geared towards the nominal. It's come to my church. It's come to Easter and Christmas. It's come to my event that's designed to reach someone with a nominal framework. The assumptions I have, the language that I use is good. And let me say this, that's not bad. That's good for the right audience, right? And we still need to do it because it's not like nominals are gone. But the problem is growing percentage of people fit the apathetic, cynical, negative, and anti-Christian paradigm. And we as the church need to begin to know how to reach and disciple people that fall from in that paradigm because that's a growing percentage in this country, certainly in a city like Portland. So any questions or comments right there?
Is this downloadable?
I can send it to you, yeah, if you want. Yep. So here's kind of the last problem related to this is the gap. Because of what I just described, there is a gap between the church and this kind of secularized global youth culture. So that within a city, certainly a city like Portland, you're talking about cross-cultural mission because of the gap that exists between the church and these people. Because the way they see the world, their language, their view of morality, it's different. And so in order to engage them, we almost have to approach them like we're reaching an unreached tribe in a jungle somewhere. Because we have to learn their language. We need to understand how they see the world and speak the gospel in a way that they can understand. And so you have this challenge literally in cities all over the U.S. But I think one thing I want to get to, how are we doing? Oh, we're good. Because I'll start to respond with what do we actually do with it. Because a lot of this can feel like bad news, and certainly there, you know, things are changing. But man, at the same time, there's a hunger. People are hungry because there's more awareness that something's not adding up. That there's more, like I said, the people are more aware, man, materialism isn't adding up. People are aware of the fact that depression and suicide is rising and they're saying, what is happening? What is going on? And so I think that people are searching, but the problem is because of the gap, they're not coming to the church because they've already discounted that as not relevant. And so they have this false idea of what the church is, who Jesus is, and so we have to overcome that because they're not coming on their own. Any questions, comments here?
Yeah, I'm just thinking out loud that I think we kind of almost had a culture in the church of hiding our deeper issues.
Yeah, sure.
And giving a false impression of sufficiency.
Yeah.
Or you're not allowed.
Yeah.
So isn't that something you think we would be well advised to begin changing if we're going to really be welcoming?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, obviously. Yeah, what's interesting is even though social media has created this idea that everyone's okay, like that, but because of that, people in the, like, amongst secular young people are actually talking more about how they're not okay. And so there's almost created, even in the secular world, it's become more acceptable to be open about how you're not okay, like that Al Mills video certainly illustrates that. And so, yeah, I think that people, obviously, I think through all times and all history, people want authenticity. They want a place. I mean, the Christian gospel, that's one of the flaws that people believe. One of the lies they believe is they you know, accuse Christians of being hypocrites. But we're all hypocrites. Of course we are. The gospel message doesn't say that we're perfect. And so, yes, we certainly need to illustrate that and allow people to come as they are and then work through things. Yeah. Any other thoughts or questions?
Well, back to the gap for a second. You can go up to that back slide.
This one?
Yeah.
Or
the last slide, backsliding. No, the one in front. In terms of the church, I think a lot of times people equate winning in their evangelistic efforts by people that work in the church. I think people are expecting that they equate church and Jesus to be one and the same, when in fact people oftentimes in their evangelistic efforts are trying to win for their institution,
yeah,
as opposed to winning for the kingdom.
Yeah, that's a challenge. I think one of the challenges is for the church is because of our history and because of the nature of, you know, and obviously this is more evangelist group, so it's going to be a little different. But the nature of churches, who leadership of churches are shepherds, and they tend to have different gifting. The challenge for the church, because historically it was come to my church event, come to my Saturday morning breakfast, you know, event for men, and okay, now I'm going to reach people. We all know this, but it's more pronounced today than ever. The work of evangelism and discipleship has to actually happen outside of the church. And that's hard for churches because it's like, well, no, I can't count those people in my building, you know. And so that is a challenge for sure. Yeah. One of the things as a mission, I haven't shared at all what we do, but one of the big things we do, we're relationally present in the scene and we use creative evangelism. But then when it comes to discipleship, one of the things we do, and we work with the local church to help do this, is we have to create discipleship bridges, which means discipleship actually starts where they are and not necessarily within, because just because you're reaching someone doesn't mean now, especially from the group that we're talking about, doesn't mean they're ready to kind of walk into a church context. They need to begin discipleship where they are in their context. So that often means doing a Bible study at a bar or at a cafe. And for people that aren't even yet given their lives to Jesus, but they're curious and they're open and you begin to grow and be discipled. And yes, eventually drawn into a community because they need that. But a lot of times discipleship has to start where they are.
And when they come to faith, they're still in a place where they know a lot of people that don't know.
That's the other thing.
So if we take them out of it, then we cut off their...
Yeah, rather than teaching them how to be followers of Jesus, as we in our mission we say they're seen, if we take them away, and what happens is we kill that opportunity for disciples who make disciples who make disciples. Because some of the coolest stories we can all talk about are people that came to know Jesus and then began to reach all their friends, right? But if we pull them away or we don't teach them how to be a follower of Jesus in their context, then we lose that opportunity.
Well, yeah. We need to create new believers who can tolerate existing believers.
Maturity,
church,
yeah.
You're like, who are all these kooks?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, and, you know, I'm going to try to get this kid to come to my church and deal with, you know, like, in some cases it may be like, this is the first time they ever had a loving group around them.
Yeah.
In other cases, it might be they walk in and they feel so judged, it's like, I'm never going to that place again. So it's like, you know,
that is attention.
So, like with me, like with skate ministry, I, you know, if I can get a kid to love Christ enough then he can see past all the issues to be like, man, I just love Jesus, and okay, we all got our issues, and then they can like, okay, I'm gonna go there because these other people love Jesus too.
Yep.
And we'll work from there, you know. Just like, and that's
a big part of it.
You know, just getting people to be like, I want Jesus, and I'm willing to tolerate everything else that comes with it.
To me, the maturity goes on both levels. A new believer, as they grow, the less that stuff matters. And then at the same time, a person that's a long follower of Jesus, as they grow, that they can. One of the things I talk about with churches a lot, because a lot of people were like, most pastors will recognize the problem but have no idea what to do about it. Like this problem, no one says that's not true. Like they all agree with it. They just don't know what to do about it. And one of the things that I talk about is it goes back to the broken heart. A lot of times we, as followers, all of us are selfish. And so churches, people at churches are selfish. That's why we get hung up on worship styles and the color of the carpeting and things like that.
Coffee,
blah, blah, blah. And so what I always say is rather than, because they're always, I say this because that question is, what do you do? And my first answer to a church is, it's not about what you do, it's about God breaking your heart. Because if your heart's, if you can allow God to break the hearts of people in the church, then they're going to start to give up their rights to things a certain way that they like it, because they're willing to reach people that are different. And so it starts with a broken heart. And so we do a whole training on apologetics and creative evangelism. I don't want to even talk about that until we talk about God breaking your heart for the lost. Because that's all useless until your heart is broken. And I think that's what a lot of people in the church need, is their heart to break enough where they'll give up. Because that's what love is, right? The extent to which you'll sacrifice, that's how you know you love someone. And so, yeah, that's how a lot of things that I'm dealing with right now. So, other thoughts or questions?
So, seeing a lot of a problem, but
yeah.
I guess I kind of had it in my mindset that
you were like,
okay, we got there some tools
that
we want to use to, like, how do we engage and how do we appropriately run after.
Let's dig into that a little bit. So I've already kind of alluded to it first. The first thing is the foundation. The source of power, which is prayer, and the motivation, which is love. Nehemiah 1:4. Our hearts need a break, and then we need to respond in prayer. No methodology, no slick apologetic conversation will save anyone if God's power isn't in it. So we start there, and we always, always, always start there. Once that's foundation's in place, we can talk about some things that help us. Now, I am doing another session tomorrow. It's focused on artists and creators, but we're going to kind of dig into practical. So we will dig into more practical stuff tomorrow as well. But first thing, isolation is our enemy. So if we see this as cross-cultural missions, we got to be present. We got to be where they are. And so often in the church, we have this us versus them mentality. Now, as evangelists, I'm sure that's not quite as big of an issue here, but we got to be where they are and just be present. So oftentimes we're answering questions that people are not asking because we assume. So the hard work of being present and being, you know, breaking the isolation, because that's a huge issue, and then meeting that with authentic community. So community is an unbelievable way to engage the global youth culture because they are so lonely. And to start that with mercy will dispel a lot of the misconceptions that they have about Christians. If you draw people into a community that's merciful, and that draws people, and they, first of all, you meet that need of community, and then they start to break down those lies that they believe about God, and you meet them at their place of greatest felt need. Like the things we've talked about, loneliness, sexual brokenness, depression, anxiety. We've seen a lot of that in our mission. So this example, this is Maria, and she's from Madrid, and we have a team in Madrid, and she's an actress. And one of our team members is also an actress, and they met on set. And this girl lives a lifestyle of polyamour, which is when you have many different sexual relationships at the same time with different people. And she was drawn into the community of our team there, not required to change anything, but drawn into the community, was so blown away by Christian community that she'd never experienced before, that she began to open up and share about the stuff that she was dealing with. And it's funny because no one had to convince her that her lifestyle was destructive. She began to open up about that, and through the community and through the relationship she developed, they began to speak truth. She started to come to these informal Bible studies and get in the Word. And eventually, through a process like that, she ended up giving her life to Jesus and was baptized just last year. So that's an example of drawing people in through community. But the challenge is that's long. It takes longer than just like one conversation. But community tends to be a powerful way. The other thing is relevant language. So if, again, it's basic missions principles. If we're going to know people, we need to speak their language. We're only going to know it if we're there, if we're present. A lot of people have asked, like, how do we learn the language of the global youth culture? And what I a lot of times say is it's not something you learn by textbook. It's learned by immersion, right? You've got to be there. And so that you can, because, man, we have such in-house terminology. And even in evangelism, we have a lot of in-house Christianese terminology that we think means something, and maybe it did to a nominal Christian audience, but it doesn't anymore. And so we gotta be careful about the in-house terminology. We're using overly religious symbolism and imagery. So a lot of times we use biblical, stories from the Bible, or maybe parables of Jesus, but we forget that Jesus used those parables because they were very relevant to the time, right? But then we use, like, Jesus is the good shepherd. Well, I haven't seen a lot of sheep running around Portland, you know what I mean? So we got to be careful of our religious, you know, symbolism, gently challenging a presupposition. So remember, we talked about the incoherence of the worldview. So when we talk to someone, and I do this a lot, where, you know, it's just basic apologetics, where you talk about if there is no right and wrong, then, you know, you begin to challenge some of those views that they have. Oh, well, what about this scenario? And it's not that that's the gospel in itself, but you're, as Ravi Zacharias said, you're removing the bushes that get in the way of the cross. So gently challenging some presuppositions. And then, as I already mentioned, finding common ground in perennial felt needs. So I'm going to actually, I think I'll give you an example of this. It's just audio. You can see video a little bit. This is one of our missionaries. His name's Luke Greenwood. He's our European director. And this was him in a club in Madrid last year. And the reason I did this was a highly sophisticated secular club where they asked him not to translate the message because everyone spoke English, and they were insulted that they would translate it. And they did a rock concert at this club, and then afterwards preached the gospel. And so this is him preaching the gospel in this secular nightclub in Madrid. Everything that we've described today, that was the audience. And I want you to just listen to how he shared the gospel, because I think it's a really great example of using relevant language and challenging assumptions and building. Yep. Well, let's take a look and we can analyze it.
You know, it's normal. We're all the same. We're all imperfect. We're not getting it all right. We're human. That's how we are. But I think that we have this deep sense of dissatisfaction because there are people made for something more. I believe with all my heart that every single one of you are precious. Like precious beyond everything in this club, in this world, in this city. You are amazing because you were made, you were designed, you were created, and you have a purpose. You have something you're supposed to live for, something I'm supposed to live for, and we're not satisfied until we find it. And I don't think it's something that any book or philosopher or scientist or politician can give us. I think this is something beyond all of that. In fact, I think it's a deep sense that we need to make peace with our origins, with our roots. And the problem is, there has been a number of lies that has kept us away from that. Religion has kept us away from finding truth in one sense, because it's controlled it, it's made a system that you have to follow, and if you don't follow it, you're not good enough. And so most of us don't feel good enough. And most of us feel like, okay, that's not for me, whatever. That's one lie. There's another lie that the system of the world tells us that you just have to keep living and just trying to make it on your own, and maybe one day you'll manage, and we just keep trying and trying and we never get there. And so again, we're pointing this lie. But I think there is truth. I believe there is absolute truth. There is something we can find. And I think it is beyond ourselves. I think it is in the one that made us. And I think that what we're looking for is to make peace with that one who made us. And the only way we can make peace with him is by knowing him. And he came to this earth so we could know him. And here's a crazy statement. I'm going to say this and you think I'm talking about religion, and I'm not.
But there was a man called Jesus who walked on this earth and said that he was God himself, bringing peace to all people. And he died a horrible death, and he rose from the dead. And this story just got trapped in a box called religion, and we've forgotten it and left it aside. I believe there is so much to that story, so much beyond everything else. And I believe that because of his death and resurrection, I can have peace with God right here, right now. And I can be full, I can be satisfied, I can have true joy. And I think it's for everyone. I don't think it's for good people, religious people, people who wear certain types of clothes. I think it's for everyone, every one of us right here, right now. So I want to do something kind of crazy that you don't usually do in a club, or maybe you don't do it at a rock concert, but I'm going to talk to God, and I'm going to ask that he speaks to us. And maybe you're here and you're thinking, I don't believe that, and I respect you for that. But maybe you're here and you're going, there's something in what he's saying that makes sense, and I want to know more. And if that's you, then I just want to ask that God would show himself to us. So God, thank you that you're here. And Jesus, thank you that you died for us. And I ask that you would reveal yourself to us, and that you would give us peace. I give my life to you, and I ask you to give me that peace. So forgive me for the mistakes I make, for the failings that I make, but that I might be able to know you. So come into my life. In your name I pray. Amen. See, now that's a prayer that anybody can pray in your own words.
What do you think? Pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That, especially consider the context. What stood out to you about the words he used or the approach he took?
Well, it's very visual in terms of putting the person of Jesus in the box of religion.
Yeah.
I like that. That was tangible in terms of the mind's eye.
Yeah. And you consider the context. Spain, very religious, Catholic. A lot of young people have a negative perception of religion. So he's really speaking to lies that he knew they believed. Yeah, which is big. He created this sense of together. Yeah. What else?
Well, obviously, if you're speaking in that context, you would say, well, yeah, we know we've screwed up. We're here at the club because that's what we do. We come here to do whatever we do. And so you didn't really have to speak to the fact that, you know, by the way, just in his death, we're all, you know, he's speaking to a culture who's highly religiousized.
Yeah.
And so he can just go straight to the point of, hey, let's just put that aside and just look at who we're missing.
Yep. Good.
He was very one with the people he was talking to. There wasn't an above below kind of thing.
Yeah.
And very, very simple, you know, there were no barriers in the words he used.
Yep. That's good. Was there any words that he used that surprised you? Or like, or maybe used words that normally we use other kind of religious words? Like the way he described sin was one thing I thought, or the idea of like at the beginning he was this kind of this longing. It's what I find interesting is when you talk to people, they tend to have this in the global youth culture. They tend to have this kind of combination of secular scientific view of the world which is a real meaningless world. But then they want the spirituality, so it tends to be this kind of pantheistic Eastern thing. So, but he was talking about, he kind of was drawing on their desire to have something beyond the natural but not using overly religious language in a formerly Catholic nation. So it was very intentional, the words he used.
Did anybody come to faith that much?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, it's the same place where the girl before in Madrid. Right. So we had a team there.
That's awesome.
So. So, there was.
Well, and it's funny too, because in the traditional mindset is you have to have some sort of response.
Yeah. Well, there was a response afterwards.
Like altar call. Yep. All that stuff. Well, whereas here it's like, hey, let's have a conversation. Yep. Let's talk after or whatever.
Yeah. And I still do believe people need to be invited.
Sure.
And that, like, we don't want to lose that.
Sure.
But you also have to know the context. I cut him short. You know, he does invite people to come and talk to him. But, I mean, you're in a club. He's just prayed out loud as a model for what they can pray. This is, you have to consider the context.
Yeah.
Anything else? Couple of, let's see. couple of other things I'll just make a quick mention because there's other stuff. One thing is ultimately we have to remember that what people need is the cross. Like one of the things that I always remind myself is there's only one solution to the problem of sin, and that's the message of the cross. And the message of the cross is where the power is. And in 1 Corinthians 2, 1-5 says that that Paul preached Christ and him crucified so that people would not be convinced by human wisdom but by God's power. What the global youth culture needs is to experience God's power, and the power of God is in the message of the cross. So how can we communicate the message of the cross in a relevant way? Now, sometimes I think we do that in kind of old school ways that doesn't connect. So we have to get a little more creative, we need to know people a little better so they can communicate the uncompromised message of the cross in a language that they can understand, because that is where the power, as we all know, preaching the gospel always requires courage, and there's always a sense of foolishness involved. You can't get away with that no matter how relevant we are. And so we never want to stop short of preaching the message of the cross, but you do it in the context of community. You do it in the context of understanding people and speaking in the relevant language. But then, yes, we've got to preach the message of the cross. All right. Well, we're low on time here. I do have a couple resources for you. We have a book called Jesus and the Secular World, which basically goes into a lot more depth of what I've talked about today. So you can grab one of those for free if you want one. We also, in our mission, we have a podcast called Provoke and Inspire. We basically talk about this topic in various contexts all the time, how to reach people from the global youth culture, from the secular humanistic mindset. So Provoke and Inspire podcast. Those are two follow-up resources. Oh, also, the guy that you heard in that club, Luke Greenwood, our European director, wrote a book called Global Youth Culture. I have a few copies of that as well. So if you want to pick one, you can just take one. Other than that, any final questions? Or I'll certainly be up here to talk if anyone wants to talk afterwards.
When it comes to discipleship,
yeah,
you mentioned that when you start doing things in the places they are.
Yeah.
Do you recommend it? Do you have, or what do you suggest in terms of
material or?
Yeah, or and ways yeah. to approach someone is interested or have specifically accepted Christ and
yeah.
I want to change whatever. Because it's not the standard way, you know?
Right. One of the models, which is, it's just inductive Bible study, we have an informal Bible study model, which is basically create a natural space, not a church, where people can come, and it's not I'm the presenter, you're the student, it's let's open the scriptures, and yeah, you've got to have the skill of guiding a conversation like that, but let's let the scripture speak, and that's really conducive for the culture, to have that conversation, and then scripture will speak, right, and begin to, so, but create a context where people can come. The other thing is create a community. So one of the things we do a lot in our missions, we have community houses. So in cities around the world, people will rent a big house with 6-7 rooms, and they'll fill 3 or 4 of them with Christians, and then you'll have a steady stream of guests, and then they'll have parties and barbecues and Bible studies and create community. And a lot of times people will hear the gospel message through one of our evangelistic endeavors, be curious, not necessarily like Jesus, but be willing to come to a neutral space where they develop relationships and, okay, now come to this Bible study. So we really see that bold proclamation combined with community and then allowing them to like engage with scripture in that context is really powerful. So, yeah.
I think young people who are going to be outspoken about their faith are going to face greater persecution, like our brothers and sisters around the world. So do you have anything to help encourage them or prepare students for that?
Yeah, and just in terms of the opposition they're going to face. And yeah, I mean, that's, in one sense, in the U.S. culture, because we're losing that nominal thing, and because people see, like, kind of fundamental Christian morality as actually not just your own view, they actually think that is wrong. We do need to be able to stand on that truth. I think for the biggest thing is that it's no longer can be a cultural thing for any of us. We need to have that our faith has to be a real relationship with Jesus that out of that conviction and that intimacy, that's where you see the courage of the apostles. It's intimacy with Jesus. And so I would say They got to know Jesus and then learn to be able to defend your faith. Well, that's another thing is our faith is absolutely coherent and can be defended, but the view of the world is that it's not. And so how can we equip ourselves and our young people to be able to defend the faith? Of course, in a loving way, in a way that isn't like us versus them, but, you know, yeah. So I don't know. Intimacy with Jesus is always the answer, followed by some, you know, how do we equip ourselves to defend the faith?
Don't you feel like that video you showed about like everything being accepted, live and let live, can also be an opportunity?
Of course.
People might be more willing to listen.
Yes. Like, that's right.
Where because of that is kind of the mindset of like, well, you can believe that and I respect you for that.
It's good. Yep.
It almost opens up.
It's true.
Sometimes more conversations because they're willing to actually listen to what, at least hear you out.
That's right.
Defending the faith, I think, is a key point of like educating.
Yeah.
You know, and then the flip side of that is there's always a mix of younger people who've been, they think of church, you know, or religious, their grandparents.
Yeah.
The version of church.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Faith versus, you know, some different ways that churches operate.
Yep. Yeah, that's good. You do see an openness to spiritual conversations because of that. So you do see a very like anti... What I find is all the anger and hostility is online. In person, you get a whole lot less of it, right? Because people are not quite as courageous. And so if you can engage... what's so cool is if you can connect with people personally, a lot of times all those views... Because when it's a real person that you're sitting in front of who represents that Christianity that you hate, it changes a lot. And so, yeah.
And if you ask them, okay, you found some really strong feelings against Christians and Christianity.
Yeah.
Could you help me understand
how that came about? Asking questions is huge. And then, like I said, last Saturday we did this focus group. So we had like all these secular young people and we just asked them a ton of questions. By the three quarters of the way in, they were saying, because we'd been asking them questions, they were asking us, and it was like teeing it up to share the gospel. So it's amazing when you ask questions, they definitely open up, and yeah, so it's cool. All right, well, thank you guys. Come grab a book if you want one. Otherwise, I'll be around. So thank you.